Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate, and today I'm joined by Jeff Bean, Collections Manager of Herpetology at the North Carolina State Museum of Natural Sciences. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you want to get started off on how you first got into herpetology and how you eventually became the head of collections manager for NC State Museum?
Well, I can't remember not being interested in herpetology. As from the moment that I was alive and able to rub two brain cells together and perceive the world, I was always more interested in living things than non-living things. They moved around and did interesting things. So life things were more interesting than non-living ones from the beginning. I'd look outside the window and see these colorful birds that were moving around, and I wanted to know more about them. Insects I'd find in the yard, they were just fascinating. But reptiles and amphibians, they were always my favorite. There's a lot of reasons why, probably. I think one thing that really sparked it off was when I was 3 years old, a rough green snake crawled out from the toy box inside my bedroom. And I was just kind of blown away by that. Green's been my favorite color ever since then, and snake's one of my favorite life forms. But I also gravitated toward reptiles and amphibians because they were so widely misunderstood. I found myself in a world where the things I loved and were fascinated by were feared and hated by all the people around me, and I never could quite figure out why. I had a kind of a sheltered childhood. Of course, nobody had internet or anything back then. Nobody had computers. I was just raised by normal parents in a suburban neighborhood in central North Carolina and was taught to fear snakes, and some lessons just don't take, and that one never did sink in for me. I was always just fascinated by them and fascinated even more by other people's fear of them. So growing up, as soon as I could read, I started reading things about reptiles and amphibians and other living things and realized most of the things I've been taught were all wrong. So I started rejecting everything else I was taught as well, I guess. But all through my childhood, I found kids in the neighborhood that would go out and look for snakes and frogs, as most kids will, but they weren't really into it as much as I was. It was just something cool to do for them for a while, and then they'd get bored with it. But I instead of getting bored with it, I got more and more interested in it as time went by. And it really wasn't, it was the same through high school. You know, people thought you were weird if you liked snakes and frogs and lizards. It's not so much that way now, but it was back then growing up in the 60s and 70s. It really wasn't until my final year of college that I found a group called the North Carolina Herpetological Society, and that really changed my life. I really met my people then. And when I got out of NC State University in 1982 with a bachelor's degree in zoology, it was hard to find a job. I was considering going to graduate school, but organic chemistry and calculus and things like that had destroyed my grade point average and my love of academia. I did well in some subjects and some I didn't. In general, didn't do very well in an academic setting, but I learned much better on my own. At some point I guess it was late 1984, I stopped by the Museum of Natural Sciences to talk to my acquaintance, Alvin Braswell, who worked there at the time. And I went there to talk to him about a tiger salamander population that I'd found in southern Wake County, which was kind of a big deal at the time. They were only known from a few areas in the Sandhills and coastal plain. This was the first Piedmont population. So while I was talking with him about that, he asked me what I was doing. And I said, well, I'm just trying to make ends meet. I'm doing taxidermy. I'm doing a couple of part-time jobs, and I'm thinking of trying to go back to grad school or something. And he said, well, we've got a part-time position here. Are you interested in it? And a few minutes later, I went upstairs and filled out an application. I didn't hear from them for quite a long time, but about 6 months later, they called and asked me when I could start work. And I said, Monday morning. So I got this part-time position. It was working with the mammal collection and fishes and reptiles and amphibians for a while. And I did that for quite some time. And finally, the position was three-quarter time. Finally, it was made full-time. And after a year at the museum, I learned much more than I did my 4 years as an undergraduate. And I never ended up going back to graduate school. I just stayed in that position. It was a research technician position. After about 10 years, I was promoted to a curator one or collections manager position. And that was really where I wanted to be. So I never did go back to graduate school. And I was lucky to get that position. I'd never be able to get it today without at least a master's degree if I applied for it now. But 39 years and 3 months later, I'm still here.
That's awesome. So when you first started off as a research technician, what were some of your roles and job tasks?
A lot of the same things I'm doing now. I was preserving specimens when they came in. I was, you know, just learning all the things that we did in this museum as a research collection, and the collections more than quadrupled in size since I came here. It was we were in about the 25,000 catalog numbers, and now we're in the 112,000 catalog numbers. We've got about 300,000 specimens. A lot of those have come from other collections that were orphaned. Sometimes a researcher at a university will build a big research or teaching collection, and then when they retire, the administration says, what are we going to do with this? We don't want this stuff anymore. So we take those collections and process them. And a lot of my job has been processing that backlog, but we do so many other things too. We do a lot of field work, and we do a lot of education and outreach and writing and publishing and proofreading manuscripts and reviewing manuscripts. And it's something different all the time. Never gets old to me.
Yeah. I was just about to ask about your field work. So in the field, what do you do?
Well, most of my field work I end up doing on my own time. I might count work time for it, but it just turns into comp time that goes away eventually. We do a lot of just general field work, trying to document what occurs where in the state, and we keep in natural history information on all the reptile and amphibian species in the state, where they occur, how big they get, how many young they have, what they eat, what eats them, what their status is. I do a few specific projects. I work with bog turtles a little bit in the western part of our state, just mark recapture studies and monitoring and some habitat improvement. Most of the field work I do is in our Sandhills region. I do some radio telemetry work down there. I've done radio tracking with pine snakes, coach whips, chicken turtles, and southern hognose snakes for about 25 years now. And I've done a lot of work, a lot of just road survey work with southern hognose snakes, just gathering all the information that I can about that species. When I was first started to do that, nobody knew or cared anything about them. And now everybody flocks to our state in the fall to try to find southern hognose snakes so they can post pictures on Instagram and show their friends and all that. But I kind of blame myself maybe for stimulating some of that interest, which I regret. But I just basically gathered data on those upland sandhill species. And a few other side projects.
Yeah. What would you say has been your favorite species to work with?
I'd probably pick southern hognose snakes if I had to. I'm very fond of bog turtles as well and pine snakes. I have a really soft spot for specialists, particularly those in the sandhills or the upland sandhills communities. Things like gopher frogs and tiger salamanders, big favorites too.
Yeah. So what would you say are some of the threats facing the animals that live in these upper sandhill regions?
Well, the big threats, habitat loss. I mean, every threat you can think of just goes back to people. It's things people do. We've introduced fire ants, and they're a problem for a lot of those species too. Road mortality and just habitat loss and fragmentation. Maybe poaching to some degree, but I think it's just mainly habitat loss.
Okay. And with southern hognoses, where I live in Ohio, we have eastern hognoses, and they're state endangered. Where you're at, are southern hognoses threatened, or are their populations seem to be doing healthy or have like a steady decline?
They've had a pretty steady decline. They're state listed threatened species. They were listed as special concern and just fairly recently upgraded to threatened. They used to be pretty common species in some parts of the state, and now they're completely gone from some areas of the state. And our Sandhills area is still a pretty big stronghold for them, but just in the last few years, I've seen fewer of them. I actually go out looking for them now. I see more herpers than I do snakes, and used to never see anybody out there.
Yeah. So what would you say are some of the biggest roles that museums play in herpetology and conservation and public outreach?
Well, our research collections, they document, if nothing else, they're documenting what we're losing. Every specimen, I tell people that our collections are like libraries, except we have specimens instead of books. People are always borrowing. Researchers are always borrowing our specimens or coming in to work with them to take morphological data, to do all sorts of studies. We've loaned out specimens for every kind of reason you can think of. And a lot of those localities where these things came from are paved over and gone now. So each one of these specimens represents a point in time when that species occurred in that place. And we've had many instances of new species being described just from looking through museum collections, large series of these animals, and realizing there's more than one species here. Of course, now genetics is a big trend, and we have been building a big genetics resources collection. We take fresh tissue, usually liver tissue, from everything that comes in now and store it in various media in minus 80 Celsius freezers. And we have probably more people borrowing tissues now than we do actual specimens. But we still do have people working with specimens quite a bit, still doing the old morphological work. And someday everything in the world will be sequenced, and I think people will be going back to that morphology again.
Yeah. So have there been any species described from samples you've had in NC State's collection?
There have been. The mimic glass lizard, Ophiosaurus mimicus, was described by my late colleague and very dear friend, Bill Palmer, who passed away early last year. He was looking through glass lizards and realized, some of these things are different. His species description, he was old school. He was not a geneticist. So his description, which came out in 1987, had no molecular component to it. It's one of the last herp descriptions in the U.S. that I know of that didn't have any kind of genetic component to it. It was all morphology, but genetic work done later bore up just the very same conclusions that he had. Also, the Carolina Sandhill salamander, Eurysia arenicola, that was described a couple of years ago. We knew for a long time that it looked different from the two-line salamanders in the surrounding area. It had a bright red coloration, at least some individuals did, and a lack of bold stripes on the side, either no stripes or very faint stripes. It occurred only in our Sandhills region, and it took about 50 years to finally sort out the morphology and the genetics and to show that it was a distinct species. And I was one of the 10 co-authors on that paper. But Brian Stewart, my supervisor and our curator, he finally took the lead on the genetics part of it. He's a very good molecular biologist.
Okay. So in the state of North Carolina, are there any particular species of herp that seem to be doing well, if not better, with all the recent habitat change versus other species that are obviously facing decline?
Well, there's a few species that are doing pretty well. Bullfrogs are doing pretty well with all the farm ponds in the state that didn't used to be there. Fowler's toads are doing well. They like farm ponds and habitats like that, where the Piedmont didn't have many ponds and lakes originally. It was all streams. There were very few natural lakes in North Carolina. So some of these artificial wetlands, irrigation ponds, and things like that have been good for a few amphibians. The green tree frog and the squirrel tree frog have both been expanding their range north and west in the state. They used to be strictly coastal plain species, and now you can find them in the western Piedmont. They've just been slowly expanding. A few other species are still holding their own. Things like black racers and copperheads and five-line skinks. But most species are declining for sure.
Okay. North Carolina is home to the northernmost population of the American alligator. Do you think that particular species is going to do well, or do you think they're going to decline in the state with all the things happening there?
Well, I think with the climate slowly warming, they may be expanding northward a little bit. We continue to find them a little further north in places that they didn't used to be. How they're getting there, are they moving there on their own, or are people putting them there? We don't know, but they seem to be doing okay. They're certainly losing ground in some of the coastal areas. Most humans just don't like to have alligators around. They're afraid of them. But other people do, and we've got a lot of biologists working with alligators, and not a lot, but a couple of biologists working closely with alligators in the state to try and monitor their populations. The state tried to pass a hunting season on them a few years ago. They actually did have a short hunting season. I think only one was actually taken, but that was shut down in for a need for further research. They're actually a state-listed species, so it was mysterious to me how they could open a hunting season on a state-listed species. But there you go.
Yeah, the first wild alligator I ever saw was actually in North Carolina. It's when I visited the battleship, North Carolina.
That's a good place to see them. Lake Waccamaw is the other very good place to see them.
And also North Carolina is also famous for those frozen lake f frozen pond alligators you see videos of where their snout sticking through the ice.
Yeah, cold doesn't seem to be quite as limiting factor as people might suspect. It's more habitat, I think, than it is temperature.
So, what can people do to help support museums and by extension, their roles in herpetology and reptile conservation?
Well, donate money. Everything runs on money these days. Museums are always short on money and funding to do research and to expand. Our collection has grown so large, we need to expand really badly, and we don't have the money to do it. A lot of museums are closing down and losing their collection space. They're just the value of these big research collections is just not understood by the average person.
Okay. And if someone somehow comes across an animal that, say, like a fresh carcass, something like that, and they want to preserve it as a specimen, would a museum accept that specimen, or would it have to be collected in a certain way by employee of the museum?
No, we take salvaged specimens from people routinely, and gladly accept them. All we need is the precise locality, the date, and the collector. Coordinates, if possible. If not coordinates, then distance and direction, the nearest road intersection, as precise a locality as possible. And we prefer to get the specimens fresh and not frozen if people can get them to us within a very short time. Keeping them either refrigerated or on ice, they'll last for up to 7 to 10 days. We don't freeze specimens if we can help it, because freezing forms ice crystals, which ruptures the cell membranes, and it prevents the formalin from fixing the tissue properly. So the result is a more of a soft, mushy specimen that doesn't hold up as well over time. But we do have many specimens in our collection that were frozen, and sometimes freezing is the only option. But yes, we'll definitely take specimens that people pick up, and quite a few of our specimens do come in that way. We very seldom go out and collect healthy animals from our state anymore. Some of our staff will do that in far corners of the world that haven't been explored yet, but North Carolina has been pretty well documented. But I just tell people every single specimen is different. And then people say, well, why do you need 750 black racers? Well, we don't need them. We just make use of them. If they're already dead and have good data with them, we can get information from them. We can get tissue from them and see how they differ from others. There's all kinds of information we can glean from these animals. So as long as we have space for them, we continue to take even common species, as long as they're in good shape and have good data.
Yeah. So I don't know how much research or work you've done with rat snakes and their MESA classification, but I'm kind of tempted to ask about that.
Yeah, it's kind of a big taxonomic mess. You know, I still call rat snakes Elaphia obsoleta. I don't even use Pantherophis anymore. I mean, we have them labeled that. We know what they are. But if we changed the name in our on every label and every catalog ledger entry and every entry in our database, we'd be just be playing musical chairs with names all day long. It's the same with, you know, names like Rana versus Lithobates and Bufo versus Anaxarus and Emesis versus Plesiodon, and it just goes on and on. I understand that genetics are showing us new things we didn't know about lineages and relationships, but I think it's almost out of control in some ways, especially with some of the plethodontid salamanders. I'm not convinced those salamanders think they're different species in some cases where we're seeing. I'm not convinced that a different lineage means it's a different species. But yeah, the rat snake taxonomy is a big one, and it confuses people all the time. And you know, half the reason for having the binomial nomenclature was to show the relationships between organisms. But the other half was to have a universal name that would be known to everybody. Well, we don't have that anymore. We have, you know, 8 or 10 different names for the black rat snake that I've seen in literature in the last couple of decades. And it's just done more to confuse people than it has to clarify things, I think. Yeah. They're still rat snake.
Yeah. Joke is, you talk to a herpetologist, ask him what type of rat snake is, they struggle to find a scientific name. Yeah, some common layman is like, oh yeah, it's a black rat snake, have them all around over the place.
Yeah.
So you said doesn't work with you said tiger salamanders. You say you found kind of like the first salamanders from a particular locale in North Carolina. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, that first Wake County population. Wake County is here where Raleigh is, where the museum is. And, you know, it had been studied by herpetologists for 100 years, but nobody turned up tiger salamanders until I had a roommate in college. It was my last year in college, and I had a roommate who had a motorcycle. And I got him interested in road cruising, and we would road cruise on his motorcycle. I'd ride on the back. And one night, about 1 o'clock in the morning on a rainy night, we found a tiger salamander in the middle of a road. And I said, that's not supposed to be here. So eventually we went back and found the little pond, and it turned up there was about 4 little sites that they used in that area. They're all pretty much destroyed now. That was an interesting population. I've found a few other recent populations since then, but most of them are gone. They're hit by a double whammy. They need these high quality upland ephemeral ponds for breeding, and then they need good quality upland habitat to live in. And both of those things are just being wiped out in most places. We've still got a few good populations in the Sandhills and intercoastal plain, but very few. So they're a state-listed threatened species still.
Okay. So you actually like doing road cruising. So outside of working for the museum, are there any particular like road cruising or herping trips you've done?
I like to travel to the Southwest. Arizona and New Mexico is one of my favorite places to go, and I just went there last month, and I've made about 9 trips out there, mainly just to see the scenery and to see the different biodiversity. But I usually get salvage permits when I go out there, and I still pick up roadkills and bring them back and put them in our collection. But I go mainly just for the pure joy of seeing some of those different life forms that we don't have here. I've traveled to other places in the Southeast, but I used to want to see the world when I was young, but now I just want to stay here and defend my home state. I've never been outside the US. I've been, within a few feet of Mexico and Canada, but I've never really had any desire to go on African safaris or places like that like I used to. I still might like to go to Australia or somewhere like that someday, but I'm really happy just staying home and learning what I can about my home.
Yeah.
Haven't learned all the beetles in my backyard yet.
Yeah. If there's anything that might be more messy than rat snake taxonomics, it's insects taxonomics.
Yeah, insects are, I mean, they run this planet. They're very interesting. If I couldn't have gone into herpetology, I would have probably enjoyed having a job in entomology of some sort, but most of those are like applied pest control jobs, and I wouldn't have been interested in that. I would just be more interested in natural history and diversity.
Yeah.
Everything is connected, and I don't know how you can really be interested in one thing without being interested in everything that's connected to it.
Yeah. So that's actually something I've been growing more and more to appreciate as I get older is growing up, I've always wanted to go to other places, far off places across the globe to see wildlife. But as I gotten older, I started to appreciate more and more what I have here in my home state and my local area and kind of the unique both biological and geological history of where I'm at. I mean, where I'm at right now is actually a few miles just south of me is the southern extent of the, I think it's the Illinois or Wisconsin Glacier. I think it's the Wisconsin Glacier. And south of that is less glaciated and has slightly different herpetofauna, slightly different plant life. The topsoil is different. So as I get older, I've grown to realize more and more how important these differences are.
Yeah, every place is really equally interesting. You just have to realize it. What we've got here would just be fascinating to people in Australia or Southeast Asia or wherever. It's all part of the same planet, and it's all just wonderfully diverse and interesting.
Yeah. So you've done some other than salamanders, have you done any other work with amphibians?
Just general, we just gather basic information on what amphibians occur where, and their status and what they eat and what eats them and when they breed and that sort of thing. I've done a lot of monitoring of some of the sites for things like gopher frogs and ornate chorus frogs and southern chorus frogs and species we've just about lost from the state but are still hanging on. The only species we know that we've lost for certain, or we're pretty certain we've lost, is the river frog, Ranna hectorii, or Lithobates hectorii. They were found in this one small area of the coastal plain between from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, and then in July of 1975, the last specimen from the state was collected, and it has not turned up in the state since then, and we don't know why it disappeared. It might have been a disease. It might have been mercury levels. It could have been something we don't know about. But that I spent several years in the early 90s trying to turn that frog up in the state, just surveying all the areas where I thought it might be, and we never did turn it up again. So that's our mystery frog that's disappeared. Same things happened in Mississippi on the far end of its range. It's gone from there too, apparently. So its range is shrinking at the edges for whatever reason.
So with reptiles, do you know of any species of reptiles that have gone extinct in North Carolina, or probably went extinct in North Carolina?
Not yet. We'll probably lose the eastern diamondback first. It's just about gone. It's pretty much confined to some of the impact areas on Camp Lejeune Marine Base, a big military installation, and it's there because people can't get to it, and because the habitat is still really good, and it's a fire maintained habitat. There's still population there. There may be a few outliers outside that, but very, very few. Eastern coral snake's pretty rare too, but it's more widespread and it's more secretive, and I think it has a lot better chance to survive than the diamondback does.
Okay, with the Eastern Diamondback, was this range in North Carolina once much more extensive than today, or was it always very limited in the state?
It was limited to the southeastern corner of the state, but there were, we had records for several counties historically, and now it's down to one or maybe two counties probably.
Okay, and I'm guessing the same kind of holds true with coral snakes, but with a bit wider range.
Yeah, there's more habitat left for them. They don't need us. They don't have the big habitat requirements. I don't think they were ever super common here. Why, I don't know, but maybe a lot of times species at the very edge of their range just aren't common. And if any little thing starts happening, they start disappearing at that edge.
Yeah. And so are most of the or all the state's lizard species, are they seem to be doing well?
With a couple of exceptions, the mimic glass lizard is extremely rare, and it requires seems to require big tracts of pine flatwoods, mesic-tahydric pine flatwoods, and it's only found in a very few places. And it maybe was never common here. We have records of it from seven counties, but some of those counties are represented by just one or two specimens, just a handful of records of it from the state. The slender glass lizard's not doing particularly well either. The coal skink up in the mountains seems to be holding its own, but it's not super abundant anywhere. Otherwise, the lizards are doing pretty well. We've got a few introduced ones. We've got the Mediterranean gecko and the brown anole turning up more and more places every year. But the gecko always seems to be around cities and towns. It doesn't seem to be terribly invasive. And the brown anole we're kind of worried about because of what's happened in Florida with it, but so far it's only been found around nurseries and places that have greenhouses where it lives in those greenhouses in the winter and then expands a little bit in the summer and hopefully dies back during the cold winters.
Yeah, that's kind of the hope of us more northern states is that our winters can kill off any invasives.
Yeah. We've also got a population of Texas horned lizards down along the coast. It's been there since the 60s, and they're more of a novelty than anything else. We're not thinking of them as something that's terribly invasive. They probably do compete with fixed line race runners, and who knows what they're doing to the harvester ant populations, but they don't seem to be spreading out very much. So they're just kind of an almost cool invasive species that we have.
Yeah. So were those purposely introduced in that area?
Apparently they came from a guy who had a bunch of them in an outdoor pen, and either they escaped or he ended up releasing them, and they've just been there all that time. One time I was there walking through the neighborhoods looking for them, and I met three different people that asked what we were doing, and all of them knew this about the horned lizards, but they all three had different stories about how they got there. One person said they came from California, where of course, they don't occur, but we finally figured out there was this one guy that had a bunch of them in an outdoor pen and they escaped from there.
Okay. Kind of funny story in my home state. We only have see here, it's, I won't say it's four native lizards, or is it three native lizards? See, here's the five. We have five line skinks, broadhead skinks, eastern fence lizards. I think I'm missing another type of skink. And then we have a fifth species of invasive. Of all things, European wall lizards somehow managed to get established in the Cincinnati area.
We don't have those yet.
Yeah. Well, and turns out, from what I've read, the story is someone guy from there went on vacation in like northern Italy back in like the 60s, put a few in a trunk, brought back and released in his backyard. Now they're kind of in Cincinnati and now spreading slowly into like northern Kentucky and southwestern Indiana.
We are having black and white tegus turn up once in a while, but it'll just be one individual. As far as we know, we've got no populations of those, and we are kind of worried about those because they can dig under buildings and survive winters. And what they've done in Florida, we definitely don't want to have happen here. A lot of these exotic species are now illegal to possess in the state. Several species are, including any of the Xenopus, the African clawed frogs, brown anoles, Cuban tree frogs, things like that that are known to be really invasive.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard from friends in Florida how Cuban tree frogs absolutely devastate the local tree frog diversity.
Yeah. We've had a few turn up in North Carolina, but it's just been transported individuals. There's no evidence that they're living or breeding here yet. We've also had greenhouse frogs turn up in a couple of spots, and Rio Grande chirping frogs, apparently a small colony of those around Fayetteville.
Wonder how those got there.
Hard to say. Someone brought them in for some reason or other.
Yeah,
maybe in some horticultural plants.
Yeah, that sounds probably like the most likely option. What would you say is the one species of herp that hasn't become invasive in North Carolina, but could be that you would be the most concerned about?
That hasn't been, but could be?
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're probably most worried about brown anoles because they're here, but they're not really spreading yet. They're just in these places that have nurseries and greenhouses. But if our winters get just a little bit warmer, they could be a real problem. And the same thing with Cuban tree frogs. If they ever do get established, they might be able to survive the winters down on the coast.
Yeah. So out of all the ecological regions in North Carolina, all different ecosystems, which we say has been the most heavily impacted by human development lately?
Probably the coastal areas. We don't have as much coast protected as few of the other states do, and coastal development's just wiped out so much of our coastline. We have a few places like Cape Hatteras National Seashore that are pretty well protected, but even that is just, there's just so many tourists that go there all year and they just drive up and down the highways. They actually run over sea turtles on the beach and things like that. So it's just, the coast is toast, as some people say.
Oof.
But we're losing habitat everywhere. I mean, the Piedmont's the most heavily devastated region. It's the most populous region, but the mountains and the coast are both just getting, so many people are moving in here. We haven't got a border wall up yet.
So what do you say is the most important thing people can do to help protect their local wildlife in North Carolina?
Well, don't reproduce would be the most important thing. The sheer numbers of people are the big problem. And just to have, everybody's got to have a house. Everybody's going to use cars and computers and all this stuff during their lifetime. Even people who love wildlife and conservation, we're all consumers and we're all consuming these resources. And somehow we've got to stop our population from growing. We got to stabilize it and actually shrink it a little bit. And beyond that, just, you know, it's the little things you can do. You know, you can recycle, you can reuse, you can not drive around so much, you can just save resources. Every little thing you do to simplify your lifestyle is going to help some other living thing.
All right. Well, on that note, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Glad to be here. Glad to help out.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Sure thing.